following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
There's an old expression, you can tell you're over the target when you start taking the heaviest flak. A lot of people like to think that, you know, if you're trying to do something good and positive, especially if you're doing something in God's name, then surely everybody's going to be happy and pleased with it, right? The sad reality is that even in church, sometimes, especially in church, no good deed ever goes unpunished, does it? Somebody at some level is bound to criticize. And that's doubly true if what you're trying to do involves some kind of significant change that threatens to upset the status quo. And really, who enjoys being criticized? You know? Oh, if you do enjoy being criticized, then I have to worry about you a little bit there. Sometimes the criticism can be so harsh and so intense that it tempts you to pull back, to say, you know what, this is not what I signed up for. This is not worth it. So you walk away and you quit, which is exactly what the critic was trying to accomplish in the first place. As we've been studying the return of the Jewish exiles to Jerusalem following the what's called the Babylonian captivity in the 5th century B.C., we've seen that from the very beginning, they encountered opposition. First, when they sought to rebuild the temple there in Jerusalem, and then when they sought to rebuild the city's walls, especially when they sought to rebuild those walls. Some of that opposition and how the residents of Jerusalem handled it is described in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 4. And I encourage you, if you have a Bible handy, to turn there right now. There's one in the rack in front of you if you're here in the building and you need to look on. We're going to walk our way through this entire chapter, and we're going to see what we can learn about how they handled this opposition, hopefully to get some insight on how we can handle critics and opposition in a healthy way. Because as we see right from the very beginning of this chapter, any great work attempted in God's name is going to draw critics. Starting in chapter 4, verse 1. Now it came about that when Sanballat heard about that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near him and said, "Even though they're building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down." Now remember that Sanballat represented those who had an interest in preserving the status quo. Sanballat was the leader of a group called the Samaritans, who were Judah's immediate northern neighbor. Judah refers to the country or the territory, if you will, around Jerusalem that was settled primarily by these Jews who had returned from exile in Babylon. The Samaritans to their north were the descendants of the refugees that the Assyrians had resettled in northern Israel after they sacked that country and took away a lot of its leadership class nearly 3 centuries before. And these refugees had intermarried with the remaining Israelites there in the area of Samaria, and they basically created a whole new culture that was kind of a blend between Israelite culture and pagan culture. And the Samaritans had thrived economically and politically for centuries, as long as Judah and Jerusalem remained weak. So you can see the problem here with this wall going back up. The rising fortunes of a rebuilt Jerusalem threatened to upset that apple cart. And so Sanballat was not happy. Now this is a great reminder that often those who criticize the loudest have agendas of their own. And sometimes you can figure out how to get around that criticism by figuring out what's driving these people. Why are they standing in such opposition? Sanballat sought to disrupt the work in Jerusalem in order to maintain his own position. Now, this is also a good place to point out the difference real quick, if you allow me to chase this rabbit for just a minute. There's a difference between constructive dissent and corrosive criticism, okay? Principled dissent can actually be a healthy thing in any group or organization. It keeps us from making stupid mistakes, right? It causes us to take a hard look at what we're doing and not get involved in groupthink and not all just go off the edge of the cliff like a bunch of lemmings. Sometimes we need somebody to step back and say, now, wait a minute, have we thought this thing through to keep us from making terrible mistakes? Unfortunately, in churches, we don't always recognize that. We tend to lump dissent and criticism together. And what we need to be doing instead is seek to create forums and pathways where healthy dissent can be heard while the effects of criticism can be minimized. And we don't always do a good job of that. In fact, I've said before, I have threatened many times to every time we have a members meeting to go to a secret ballot, because I know in churches, and I've seen it happen in this church, where people are scared to speak up against something because they don't want everybody else to look at them. And so sometimes I think if we did everything by secret ballot, that might take that away. Because personally, I would rather know that a measure passed, that it was like 70-30, than to have 100% vote for it when really half the people weren't fully convinced. If I know that there's opposition, we can always back up and say, okay, what do we got to do to win these people over? What changes do we need to make? What adjustments we need to make to where we can all come together on this? Whereas if everybody just kind of looks around and says, I don't want to be the one that raises a stink, then we make stupid mistakes because we don't know that everybody's not on board. So dissent, good. Criticism, bad. How do you know the difference? Well, dissent and criticism often differ in their aims, okay? Dissent seeks to build. Its primary motivation is to make things better, whereas criticism just wants to tear down. It's intent on just tearing people down and wrecking people. Dissent and criticism also differ in their methods. And Sanballat's approach here in verses 1 through 3 illustrates several of the negative aspects of unhealthy criticism. First of all, his opposition is fueled from a negative place. It's fueled by anger, not altruism. We're told he became furious when he heard what was happening in Jerusalem. He was very angry. And that led him to belittle and dismiss those he opposed. We're told he mocked the Jews. He made fun of them. And whenever you attack the person instead of the problem, that should be a warning sign. Okay? If somebody's attacking a group as for who they are and making fun of them and mocking them and insulting them and tearing them down, that should send off all kinds of warning bells. Okay, something bad's going on here. Because healthy dissent doesn't attack people. It focuses on the problems, on the issues. Hey, here's the issue we need to address. It shows respect to those whom it is opposing. Sanballat didn't do that. He is mocking and belittling the people he opposes. And then this is a key thing right here. He spoke about his opponents, not to them. Now, we don't have any record that Sanballat ever approached Nehemiah directly to air his concerns. It may have happened, and it's just not recorded. We don't know that. I know it's an argument from silence, but we don't have any evidence he ever did that. But what we see here is that what he did instead was gather a group of like-minded constituents and complain to them, his brothers, and the wealthy men of Samaria. He had his own little echo chamber here of people who had the same interests he had, the same agenda he had, and he gathered them up together, and that's who he complained to. So he was complaining about his opponents. He didn't go address his opponents directly. And so often that's what people do. Instead of, I knew of a situation not too long ago where somebody had heard something and they went, instead of repeating it to anybody else, they went directly to the source. And when I heard about it from the source, I was so thrilled because that's exactly what we want people to do. If somebody comes to you with some story or something, go check it out before you repeat it. Because what tends to happen, people who have an interest in tearing things down, They don't go to the people involved. They go to everybody else. They try to gather up a posse. They try to get people on their side. And then when they think they've got enough people behind them, that's when they start going public. And that's what we see Sanballat doing. He's gathering his posse to oppose the rebuilding of this wall. So he gathered up a group of like-minded constituents, his echo chamber. And then his arguments, you'll notice, are focused more on tearing down his opponents than seeking a mutually beneficial solution. And you just look over some of the things he says here. First of all, he calls them feeble. He makes fun of their abilities. You know, he doesn't respect these people at all. He says, what are they doing? They can't do this. They're gonna build this thing themselves? Who do they think they're kidding? They can't pull this off. Can they offer... Now, some of the Hebrew here is a little awkward, and I have to admit, I was never the best Hebrew student, and my skills have only atrophied with time because I don't use them enough. But people who know this a lot better than I do say that what's going on here is he's basically saying it's an insult. If they think they're going to pray this wall up when he says, will they sacrifice? If they think they're just going to pray and this wall is going to rise up on its own, you know, he's making fun of their religion and their faith. Can they finish in a day? Well, no, nobody, he's exaggerating here. Nobody ever said they were going to build it in a day. But he's exaggerating there in order to mock them. Can they revive these stones and this dusty rubble from even the burned ones? He's actually exaggerating even more here by making the situation worse than it really is. Now, when the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem, they burned the gates, but the walls they just pulled down. So an archaeologist have found in some places the rubble of these walls that weren't rebuilt. You know, we talked a few weeks ago about a section that Nehemiah bypassed and did not attempt to rebuild. And those stones are not burned, which would have calcified them and made them worthless and brittle. Instead, they were able to reclaim these stones and just stack them back together and reuse them in most cases. So he's exaggerating, making the problem sound worse than it is. And I have experienced all of these over the years from people who have been critics. You know, they exaggerate, they twist, they manipulate the truth. They make things sound worse than they are. They blame you for it. Stuff that's out of your control. I've even gotten text messages from people right before I get to preach, blaming me for all the problems of the church. You know, people actually do that. And if you've ever been involved in leadership, whether it's leading a Sunday school class or leading a committee or a team, you may have experienced some of that too. But he is mocking and belittling the people that he is opposing instead of treating them with respect and approaching them in a constructive way. And his criticism, we see, also loves company. Because he's sitting there ranting and raving about how bad the Jews in Jerusalem are, and his buddy Tobiah the Ammonite is going right on. And he has to throw his two cents in there as well. He's piling on. And critics tend to draw other critics. Now, how do you handle that? When people are doing that to you, when they're subjecting you to that, what is the proper way to respond? I think it's really interesting how Nehemiah responds to this. Nehemiah shows us how to meet criticism with patience, with prayer, and with perseverance. In verse 4, what we see here, Nehemiah breaks into his own narrative to breathe a prayer against his critics. Hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity and do not let their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together in half its height, for the people had a mind to work. So Nehemiah breathes this prayer, and when you think about the fact that he is putting this down on parchment probably sometime after it actually happened, it's amazing. You can still tell he has a strong emotional reaction when he thinks about what Sanballat and Tobiah and their allies did to him. And I find that to be very true. If you've ever had somebody really come after you, there'll be times where, you know, you're just kind of going on minding your own business, trying to move things forward, and you'll hear something, or a name will be mentioned or something, and then all of a sudden it's almost like PTSD. You are right back in that criticism. And you start rehearsing all that in your mind, and you start thinking about all the things that happened to you and what that person did to you. And next thing you know, you've wasted 30 minutes thinking about it. You know? So he feels that pull. And if you read what he writes here, it is pretty intense. Lord, don't forgive these people. And we kind of recoil at that and say, why do we do that, huh? You have to realize, Nehemiah's words may have been raw, but they are real. He is expressing here what he is really feeling. His words are similar to those voiced in what we call the imprecatory psalms. Imprecatory is a word that simply means to invoke judgment on something. And there are several psalms in the book of Psalms, probably about a dozen, that have this imprecatory type nature, that are prayers invoking God to step in and right a wrong and bring justice into a situation. A good example, probably the most vivid example, is Psalm 137, where the original exiles that were carried off to Babylon in 587 BC called on God to inflict on the Babylonians the very same cruelty that they had inflicted on the Jewish people. In Psalm 137, verses 8 and 9, O daughter of Babylon, you devastated one, how blessed will be the one who repays you with the recompense with which you have repaid us. How blessed will be the one who seizes and dashes your little ones against the rock. What he's actually saying there is he's saying, I hope God sends somebody against you Babylonians that'll take your babies and throw them against the wall. Now, if that sounds abominable to us, remember, the people who wrote these words had witnessed the Babylonians do exactly that to little Jewish babies. And so they are reacting out of their pain. And what they are doing is calling for justice. When Nehemiah says, Lord, don't forgive them, what he is saying here is, Lord, don't let them get away with this. But here, notice what he is not doing. He is not strapping on his sword and gathering his posse and riding towards Samaria. He is putting this in God's hands. This is why I say he is exercising patience. Because usually when somebody criticizes us, what is our first reaction? I'm going to get them just like they got me. And Nehemiah steps back and says, no, God, this is your problem. Lord, I am putting them in your hands. He turned his concerns over to God in prayer. Maybe he was thinking about the words of Deuteronomy 32, verse 35, where the Lord says, vengeance is mine and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip, for their day of calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. Or maybe Proverbs 20, verse 22, do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and he will save you. This thought makes its way into the New Testament too. Paul in Romans 12, 19 actually quotes Deuteronomy 32. He says, never take room for your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And let me tell you, I've gotten to witness this several times over the course of my time on this world, my 54 years on this world. And let me tell you, God is much more creative about these things than you and I can be, and much more fair and much more just. Now, it may take time. God's justice doesn't always work on the timetable that we would like it to. And you may not even see it this side of judgment day, but I have seen occasions where I'm convinced God stepped in and what somebody sowed, they eventually reaped. And let me tell you, God's much more capable of handling this than you and I are. And we need to step back and put it in his hands. In fact, we are to do what Proverbs 25 verses 21 through 22 tell us. If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he is thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. When you turn the other cheek and refuse to meet evil with evil, then what you are doing, your kindness is actually bringing judgment upon the person who has offended you. Proverbs 24, verses 17 and 18 says, do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, or the Lord will see it and be displeased and turn his anger away from him. Leave this in God's hands. When you feel that the sting of that criticism or that opposition, don't take it in your own hands, but turn it over to the Lord and let him handle it. And then Nehemiah probably did the best thing he could do after turning it over to the Lord. He persevered by completing the work in the face of the opposition. What were these guys trying to do? They're trying to stop the wall from going up, right? Nehemiah turns this over to the Lord, and he leads his people to keep building the wall. And they got half the wall built halfway up to provide protection so that the enemy couldn't step in and stop things. Now, here's the thing, though. When you don't give in to that criticism, when mockery fails to deter, critics may resort to intimidation and sabotage. In verse 7, now when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls of Jerusalem went on and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. All of them conspired together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. So Sanballat and Tobiah send out this criticism. It has no effect. The walls keep going up. And so what they do is they recruited other people to start putting pressure on Jerusalem. The four groups mentioned here each controlled territory that bordered Judah. Of course, the Samaritans, as we mentioned before, they were north of Judah. Tobiah and the Ammonites occupied the territory that's now the modern nation of Jordan to the east of Judah. The Arabs controlled the deserts to the south, and the Ashdodites, the descendants of the Philistines, controlled a strip of cities on the Mediterranean shore to the west of Judah. So here you have enemies on every side, and together they are surrounding the Jewish territory and threatening the Jews from every direction. Now, since Nehemiah had written authorization to rebuild this wall from the king of Persia himself, it's very doubtful that Sanballat and his allies intended to attack them in force directly. Instead, first of all, they sought to intimidate the Jews by show of force. Bullies love to bluff. Okay? But failing that, a lot of scholars believe that the enemy forces intended some quick guerrilla action and maybe even some sabotage. And we actually have that in the text here. It says that they wanted to cause a disturbance inside Jerusalem. And that implies they were going to send forces in to stir things up from inside the city, to cause division and disruption of the work. In his book, Canoeing the Mountains, which is a book all about leading during times of change, Todd Bolsinger, who's a leadership expert and a pastor, has a chapter called, I believe the title is Expect the Sabotage. And he talks about a pastor who once attempted to lead his church in a bold move aimed at better positioning the church to reach its community. The move involved a proposal to tear down some of that church's older buildings and replace them with facilities that were better suited for the current mission. You know, that's a pretty big deal. Imagine if we came to you and said, you know what, I think what we're going to do is and we would never do this, but I think what we're going to do is we're going to tear down the children's church building and replace it with something else. Well, some of y'all can remember the exact spot in that building where you prayed to give your life to the Lord. There's a lot of sentimental value in that building. There's a lot of work. That's the original building of this church. There's a lot of work that's been done to keep and maintain that over years and update it and make it usable. Now our children's ministry is focused in there. And it's a lot of investment, a lot of emotional connection to that building. And it's the way it was at this particular church that Bolsinger describes. But the pastor, realizing there's going to be some of that opposition, he thought he was being smart. He went around to several of the key leaders in that church to enlist their support, including the man who had given most of the money to build those original buildings. And he thought he had everybody on board. And sure enough, when they came time to vote for the project, it passed. But all of a sudden, they started trying to raise the money for this, and the money wasn't coming in. So he started checking around, and what he eventually found out was that this donor, this wealthy individual or influential individual, had gotten together with some other influential individuals, and they had formed a little conspiracy. They would vote for the project, but they would limit their contributions in hopes that the project would fail. Sabotage. Yes, that kind of thing happens in churches, believe it or not. Sometimes what critics cannot accomplish openly, they seek to accomplish through sabotage and subterfuge. Now, Nehemiah did not let that stop him. What they did was they kept on working, And it's what we see here in verse 9 is an encouragement to couple our prayers with prudent preparations. We read about, you know, this conspiracy is happening in verse 7 and 8, and then verse 9, Nehemiah says, but we prayed to our God, and because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. So he led his people to pray. That's a good thing. They put it in God's hands. But that's not all they did. They also set up a guard. You know, and this is kind of a great lesson for our day because we have a lot of discussion these days about what it means to walk by faith. You know, hey, listen, I trust God to watch over my life when every time I get on the highway. I believe that nothing can happen to me until it's God's time for it to happen. But I still fasten my seatbelt. Okay, I have faith that my days are in God's hands. But I still take prudent precautions to protect myself. And that's exactly what Nehemiah and his people did. They prayed to God, they put their fate in God's hands, but they also did what they could do, which was set a guard to make preparations. And we need to follow that same two-track approach. We also need to be on guard against the effects of criticism on morale. In verse 10, Nehemiah relates this apparent song that was being circulated among the people there in Judah. Thus in Judah has been said, the strength of 100 bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish. And we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Our enemy said, they will not know or see until we come upon them and kill them and put a stop to the work. And then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, they will come up against us from every place where you turn. So Nehemiah recounts this song there in verse 11, apparently circulating among the residents of Jerusalem. They were kind of singing this as they went along. And you look at it, and it's really a depressing song, isn't it? Man, we're just working ourselves to the bone, and we're never going to get this done. Maybe the critics are right. So they are defeating themselves. And then he recounts this rumor that is circulating regarding the enemy's intentions. And he says, you know, the people that the Jews that live between us and Samaria keep telling us these guys are coming. And he says, he mentions, we get this report 10 different times. So this was pretty intense. And he said, yeah, they're saying they're coming for us. What are we going to do here, Nehemiah? Well, Nehemiah responded by taking steps to build up the city's weaknesses and build up the city's morale in verse 13. Then, in response to this drop in morale, I stationed men in the lowest parts of the spaces behind the wall, the exposed spaces, and I stationed the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. So what he does is he identifies the areas of the wall that are most vulnerable, the areas most likely where the enemy is going to attack, and he put guards there. That's where he stationed the guards. And he puts them in the lower places, they're further out, so they're going to keep the enemy from coming in the city if they do attack. And then he stations people and families. Now, I'm going to tell you, well, that's important in just a minute, but one thing I want to point out right here is he is taking precautions to shore up the weaknesses and in order to show people, hey, here's what we're doing. You see the problems. You've heard the rumors, okay? But we're taking steps to address those. And so that's a big confidence builder for the people in the city. And then Nehemiah led the people to fight fear with faith and love. In verse 14, when I saw their fear, talking about the people in Jerusalem, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. So he gathers the influence leaders in the city, the important people, the people that had everybody's ear. And this is what he said to them. Do not be afraid of them. Talking about the critics. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. And fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. So first of all, he calls on the people to focus on the Lord, not on their critics. So often we are tempted to focus on the critics who are making the most noise, to focus on our fears, and to let that drive us. Nehemiah says, no, look up. Yesterday I was walking my dog. We go for a walk just about every morning. And we passed by this one particular house, and somebody had let their Labradoodle out to do his business. And that dog was bound and determined to defend his territory. Now, you got to understand, I think my dog could take him. You know, my dog's mostly Siberian Husky. He had about 10 pounds on this Labradoodle, and he's closer to being a wolf than a poodle. So I think he could take him. But my daughter, I didn't want to have to pull them apart. So we went to the other side of the street. I'm dragging him along. But it was such a battle because Rex, every time that dog, other dog would bark, he's turning around. He didn't want that Labradoodle in his rear ready to sneak attack. And so he kept turning around to look at that dog every time it would bark. And I'm sitting there going, come on, come on. And finally I had to stop and turn his head to me and say, look at me. Look at me. Okay, let's go. Sometimes God has to do that to us. We hear that little yapping going on behind us, and we're so tempted to turn around and fear that, and God says, no, look at me. Look at me. Trust me. I am much more powerful than that little yapping dog is biting at your heels. Keep your focus on me. And that's what Nehemiah does. He says, look up, people. Don't look at the enemies that are surrounding us. You look at the Lord who's above us, the one who called us here to this task. We're going to trust him. It's like Jesus said, don't worry about those who can kill the body. You worry about the one who can kill body and soul in hell. He's the one we need to be concerned about. There's only one opinion that we need to be concerned about ultimately, and that's the Lord's. As Paul says in Romans chapter 8, if God is for us, who can be against us? Look at the Lord. Trust in him. And then, he not only did that, but he reminded the people what was at stake in protecting what they loved most. I mentioned he gathered the people and families. There's a really smart reason he did that. Because then he turns to him and he says, when you fight, if these guys attack us, remember what you're fighting for. You're not just fighting for the city of Jerusalem. You are fighting to protect your families. Now, people will do a lot more for love than for anything else. They'll do more for love than they'll do for fear. They'll do more for love than they'll do out of a sense of duty. That's why I think God says, I love a cheerful giver. You know, God doesn't want to guilt people into giving and supporting the church. He wants you to give to support the church because you love the church and you believe in what it's doing. Because you will give more, give longer, and give more faithfully out of love than you will give out of any sense of guilt or obligation. And Nehemiah says here, when you fight, if these people attack us, you are fighting for your families. Those who've served in the military know this. If you've been in combat, you know that you are not fighting necessarily. I mean, as much as we talk about believing in the flag and honoring the flag and the nation, you're fighting for that person in the foxhole right beside you. I've never been in that situation, but I've talked to many who have, and almost invariably that's what they tell me. You know, when in that moment you are fighting for the person on your right and your left. Nehemiah says, remember who you're fighting for. And remain vigilant while continuing the work. In verses 15 through 23, we're going to jump through this real quick. First of all, God's people put the critics on notice. Verse 15, when the enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. So they let it be known, hey guys, we know what you're up to. You're not going to get away with it. And then they got back to work. And then they remained vigilant against the enemy's attacks. In verse 16, from that day on, half of my servants carried on the work while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates. And the captains were behind the whole houses of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who were carrying burdens took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built while the trumpeter stood near me. So he divides the group into shifts. Half the group builds while the other half stands guard. Kind of hard to build in full armor. But even those who were building kept their weapons close by. You know, the guy's carrying a brick in one hand and a sword in the other. Guys doing the work, they got their sword strapped on. They are ready if the trumpet, the alarm sounds. So they're taking steps to protect the work. They're being vigilant. And God's people committed themselves to mutual support. In verse 19, I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So basically, he's reminding them, guys, we are in this together. So if I get in trouble, you run over and help me. You get in trouble, I'm going to run over and help you. We are in this together. And whatever God calls us as a church to do, we will be more successful if we remember we are in this together. What happens a lot of times is we start, each person starts looking out for their own agendas, their own interests. We should be watching each other's backs and realizing we are family. Focus less on what divides us and more on what unites us. And God's people stayed close together and made sacrifices to see the project through. Verse 21, so we carried on the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. So all day long they got this guard going on. At that time I also said to the people, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem so they may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day. So some of the people lived in the suburbs. And normally what you'd expect, they come in and work during the day and they go home at night. He says, no, what we need you guys to do, we need you to make a little bit of sacrifice here. We need you to do something that's a little inconvenient. We need everybody to stay in the city till we get this done. And they did it. They were willing to put aside their own convenience, their own safety, maybe concerns about their own houses, which were outside the city walls, in order to stay and see this through. They took on a sacrifice. They took on inconvenience in order to make this happen. So verse 23, neither I nor my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even of the water. Now, there's a lot of discussion over what that last phrase means, whether that means, you know, they always, the point is they always carried their weapons with them. It could be they carried their weapons with them when they went to get a drink, or they carried their weapons with them when they went to take a bath, or even when they went to the bathroom, okay? That can all be interpreted all those ways legitimately. But the point is, they always stayed vigilant because critics will always look for whatever weakness they can find for any opportune moment. As we're told in the New Testament, Satan prowls around like a roaring lion seeking whom he can devour. But they stuck together and they sacrificed to support each other. And God was able to do some great things because they trusted him and they stuck together and they didn't listen to the critics and they saw it through. As the saying goes, haters are going to hate. Well, you can say the same thing about critics. Critics are going to criticize. That's just what they do. People criticize for a lot of reasons. Sometimes it's out of jealousy. Some people just can't stand it when somebody else has something better than them. So what they're going to do is they're going to knock you down to their level. Some people criticize out of a sense of being threatened. They see life as a zero-sum game, and if somebody else is winning, that means I'm losing. So we got to do something about that. Some people criticize out of their own pain. The saying goes, hurt people hurt people. Okay? And I've been doing some study and research on this, and I'm not no expert, but people who study this tell me that a lot of times people who are really toxic and really narcissistic are that way because they are working out of some deep trauma in their childhood. They had a crisis in childhood. As a child, they couldn't control that. So now they attempt to control and manipulate everything in the present as a way of covering up that pain. So some people criticize out of their own pain. But don't ever let the noise of the critics distract your attention from the calling of God. There's a story told about George Whitefield. Whitefield was an evangelist in the 17th century from England. Tremendous impact on both England and the American colonies. Thousands of people would turn out in open-air meetings to hear him preach. Hundreds would respond to Christ. But he had, for all of his success, his share of critics. And sometimes people would send him the nastiest letters telling him just how messed up he was and what a failure he was. And some people even called him evil because they didn't agree with what he was doing in proclaiming the gospel. So the story is told that he responded to one particular letter like this. I thank you heartily for your letter. As for what you and my other enemies are saying against me, I know worse things about myself than you will ever say about me. With love in Christ, George Whitefield. Hey, God knows you better than the critics does, and God still loves you, and God still calls you to serve him. And if God is for us, it doesn't matter what the critics say. When you're trying to do something good, especially for God, expect critics. But don't let them distract you from your calling. Keep your eyes on the Lord and keep on walking in faith.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.